Hello, Juno. You're listening to KTOO. This is Tuesday, May 28th, the edition of Juno Afternoon. I'm Joan Partis. I'm sitting in for Martha Moore, who usually does Tuesdays, but she's off in Europe. Today, we'll be talking to Chris Taylor from the Canvas about upcoming art classes. Eric Boris from TrailMix will be here to highlight Saturday's National Trails Day. We'll remember the sinking of the Princess Sophia with Mary Lou Sparks and three guests from Canada. And Steve Kosis will be here with a preview of the Tuesday night planetarium presentation, The Art of the Aurora. That, Writer's Almanac, Bird Note, music, and more. Stay tuned.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. The Hopi tribe in Arizona has filed a lawsuit alleging Wachovia Bank financial advisors took advantage of the tribe. As KUNM's Tristan Autone reports, the lawsuit seeks nearly $190 million in damages for the alleged investment fraud.
According to the Hopi tribe, in 2007, Wachovia employees David Bowling and James Roy gained control of the tribe's investment accounts, causing enormous financial losses to the Hopi while making profits for themselves and the bank. Norberto Cisneros is an attorney for the Hopi tribe.
They were moving around and investing and playing with about $70 to $80 million worth of the tribe's funds. And with that, they basically had carte blanche access to it, used it in a way that benefited them and not necessarily fulfilled their fiduciary obligations to the tribe.
Cisneros also alleges that a former bank employee named in the suit engaged in similar misconduct while serving as a financial advisor to Zuni Pueblo before taking on the Hopi tribe as clients. Representatives for Wachovia, now part of Wells Fargo, did not immediately respond to requests for comment. For National Native News, I'm Tristan Autone.
The Northern Arapaho tribe consistently gets bad marks on annual audits for the way it uses federal funds on the Wind River Reservation. As Wyoming Public Radio's Irina Zhorov reports, the Tribal Business Council says it's working on management issues.
The audit findings include few internal financial controls or reporting and insufficient procedures in place for timely drawdowns. They also show a lack of proper procedures for hiring qualified workers and establishing suitable pay rates, improper loans being made to employees, incorrect payments for travel expenses, and no internal control system to put together coherent financial reports. The Northern Arapaho Business Council is responsible for managing the tribe's money. Cindy Washakie used to oversee a women, infants, and children program on the reservation. She says she complained about mismanagement to the council, but little changed.
Because when they were spending my money, I had consultants that were paid to do the training and the parenting teaching in the communities. And with them not getting paid, then they couldn't do those services. And so I was constantly on their doorstep, constantly emailing them, constantly, why is this not getting paid? Constantly having to fight for the money that's already there.
A new council took over in January, and members vowed to fix the financial management issues they say were many years in the making. The council has, quote, ordered a top-to-bottom review of all programs, both tribal and federal, to determine if either improper spending is taking place and if personnel changes are required. According to the Bureau of Indian Affairs, the tribe is currently being sanctioned for not submitting their more recent audits. The BIA is now offering money month by month instead of providing automatic lump payments. For National Native News, I'm Irina Zhorov. As the summer school break begins, the Cheyenne River Youth Project in South Dakota is offering kids options to keep them busy. Tammy Eagle Hunter is the project's wellness coordinator. She says they've stepped up programs to keep Native youth learning active and out of trouble. They're providing a safe place where young people can go to discover new interests.
We're in a really rural place where things aren't really offered. You know, there aren't gymnastic classes. You don't learn how to play the piano. Like, those things aren't offered here because it's so small and the population is small and there's not a lot of demand for it. But that doesn't mean, like, there isn't a kid out there who wants to learn how to play the piano.
They have Zumba classes, midnight basketball, and will soon provide music and video production gear. Eagle Hunter says one tip she has for parents to keep their kids busy is to help them find an enjoyable activity. During this week in 2012, the Winneman Wintu tribe ended a four-day war dance at a site on the McLeod River in California. The ceremony was held to convince the U.S. Forest Service to close part of the river for a coming-of-age ceremony. Leaders say recreational boaters have been a disruption in the past. An agreement was reached and a summer ceremony was held. The tribe is not federally recognized and not protected under religious freedom laws. This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
National Native News is produced at the Annenberg National Native Voice Studios in Albuquerque, New Mexico by Kawanic Broadcast Corporation, with offices in Anchorage, Alaska. Funding is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the Annenberg Foundation, and the Ford Foundation. Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Service.
Hello, Juno. This is Juno Afternoon, and the weather is amazing. Okay, you look out your window. It's sunny. It's high around 72. It is warm. Light winds becoming sea breezes to 10 miles per hour late this afternoon. Tonight, increasing clouds, low around 49. Tomorrow's supposed to be cloudy, a little cooler, and a chance of rain. Wednesday, rain likely. Thursday, cloudy, chance of rain. Thursday night, rain likely. All of it's likely, not rain for sure. But it has been beautiful, so we are all very happy Junoites. So you are listening to KTOO, Juno Afternoon. I am your host, Joan Partis, sitting in for Martha Moore today on this Tuesday, May 28th. And I am here with Chris Taylor from The Canvas. Hi, Chris.
Hi, how you doing?
I'm great. How are you?
Good. Thanks for having me.
Oh, we're thrilled to have you. So The Canvas offers art classes, and you have six children youth classes and three adult classes coming up just in June?
Yeah, just in June.
Wow.
And a lot more all summer long.
So. Okay. My daughter took some classes last year. It seems like there's a lot more this year. Is that true?
Yeah, so we're kind of trying to amp up the kids' programming, especially in the summer. I think there's a pretty good need for it. So basically, all summer long, we'll be doing week-long classes, like Monday through Friday, and then two sessions, so either a class will run from 9 to noon or 1 to 4, Monday through Friday, and 4 weeks a month until the end of August, basically. So we'll be pretty busy and lots going on.
That's great. So let's start with a little bit about the June youth offerings.
Okay.
So is there, it looks like you have Tlingit Basket Weaving with Ricky Tagabon, Youth Cartooning with Averill Velez, Wheel Throwing for Young Adults with Brandon Howard, Reader's Theater, Formline Relief Printing, Mixed Media Abstract Painting, and Beginning Wheel Throwing, which is like,
yeah.
It is so much.
Yeah, it's a lot. And yeah, a lot of all the teachers that are teaching these classes are fantastic. So Candace Christie, who's going to be having a show at Annie Kale's in June, showing her work, which is predominantly mixed media, will be teaching the kids' class. Ricky Tagabon is an artist here in Juneau that just won a Rasmussen grant for his weaving. So very talented artist, very talented teacher. I think that'll be a fun class. Averill Velez is also a very talented artist here in town that's shown at all of the museums, and very, very good at working with youth. Got a lot of great response. Another great youth teacher is Liz Villanueva. She works out at DZ. Great energy, very creative, fun person to be around, really good with kids.
And she's doing the Reader's Theater.
Yeah, the Reader's Theater, and she's very excited about it, and I spoke with her today. I think that's going to be a really fun class. And then Brandon Howard's our ceramic teacher, and he does fantastic work as well.
So. Right, and I know he's terrific with the kids.
Mm-hmm,
I have a lot of friends, and their kids just adore Brandon.
He's great, yeah.
So where do people go to find out more about this information? The website?
The website is www.canvasarts.org.
Okay, and there are age minimums, like some of them are 11 and up, and some are 9 and up.
Yep, and for the most part, we try to keep it 8 and up, 9 and up, and then we have classes that we've kind of distinguished a little bit for some older kids. We have the wheel throwing for young adults. We'd like that to be a little bit older, 12 and up, and that's going to be a 2-week-long class, so those are the differences. But it's just a little bit more advanced work, focusing on a little bit more technical things.
Okay. And as far as your adult classes, because I have a friend who's just taking a stained glass class right now, and she's really loving it.
Okay.
So what are you offering in June as far as art classes?
We have a few classes that are currently running, but of the ones that are starting up in June, we have a inking and watercolor landscape class, good chance to celebrate landscapes. is in the summertime here in Juneau, so she'll be going over the foundations for anyone who hasn't done watercolor or landscaping, but she's very proficient and skilled at them, so if you've had practice and just want to take something farther, good class to do that in.
And that's age 15 and up.
Yeah, she's actually had, we've had quite a few, I think 15, 16-year-olds jump in her watercolor classes before and done quite well. So.
Oh, that's great. And then mixed media painting. Let's hear a little bit about that.
So like I said, again, yeah, that's going to be Annie Kale, the artist showing down at Annie Kale's. And she's basically going to be exploring a whole variety of different mediums that you apply with your acrylic to get different textures. She's kind of a master of different textures and techniques, transparencies, thick and thin, mixed media, how to apply paper. She's going to go into gold leafing, which is a pretty fun process to get a different look with your work that you can't necessarily get with acrylic paint by itself. So that should be interesting. She's going to cover a pretty wide gamut and be open to kind of exploring the direction of the class. If they have questions, and it'll kind of guide the direction of where they go because it's such a wide area, mixed media.
Okay. And then the last class for adults, the last offering in June?
That's going to be zines, and basically that's your self-made and self-published magazines. So it's great for artists, for poets who have things, writers that they want to make their own publication, and then she'll talk about how to mass produce them and hopefully kind of maybe distribute them locally or to other cities that have a zines movement. So it's sounds like a pretty cool class. I've never made one myself, but Electra Gardiner, the instructor, has made a lot and very into that scene. So it sounds like a great class.
Right. Also, Jeff Brown, who's here in the studio as engineer, who always makes me look good, he is a master of zines as well.
Oh, really?
Yes. Awesome. Very, very funny. So, all right. Well, that sounds great. So it sounds like there's a ton of stuff happening at the Canvas all summer long for adults and for youth. And if
Correct.
You want to take a class with your kid, it seems like there's some opportunities
there. Oh, definitely.
There.
We've had that happen before, and we love it. It's a chance for parents and kids to get together and do something fun.
Yeah, that sounds great. So what about First Friday? Do you have anything happening? Because that's right around the corner.
We do. We have this coming First Friday, Luis Kunstada and David Riccio are going to be showing their works together, a collaborative show. It should be great. We'll have a lot of 2D work, so paintings, prints, digital work by David Riccio, and then Luis Kunstada is going to be doing a lot of ceramics work, raku firing, and very beautiful work. I think it's going to be a fun show.
And that's at the studio.
That's at the Canvas.
Right.
And then we have a show that has currently opened last month, but that will be up through October, and that's six of our Reach artists had worked with Brandon Howard for the last probably like 4 months, working on a whole series of ceramic pieces, so sculptures, vases, halibut wall hangings, ceramic birds. So it's a really unique show, very beautiful. It has a great video that we recorded through the whole time of their creation process, explaining how they work and has a few interviews with them. So it's a good way to get to know the canvas if you haven't.
And where is that show?
That's going to be at the Alaska State Museum,
okay.
And it's up all the way through the summer into October.
Okay, cool. So if you're just joining us, I'm talking with Chris Taylor of the Canvas. There's a whole variety of different art classes, all different types of art classes happening this summer. And the best way to find out about them is the website one more time.
Yep, and that's canvasarts.org.
Okay, and the phone number?
Is 586-1750.
Right, and just in case you don't know where the Canvas is, you want to describe where it is?
223 Seward Street. So just right up from the Wells Fargo off Seward Street.
That's right. Okay. Well, thanks for joining us this afternoon.
Thanks for having me.
All righty.
Pigeons and bullfights, the seashore he drew. Picasso, Picasso.
Hello, you are listening to KTOO. This is Juno Afternoon. I want people to know that there is recent black bear activity in the Auk Bay Bypass area near Auk Rec, and that has prompted Fish and Game to warn people to beware of the family of bears foraging alongside the road. Area management biologist Ryan Scott says people trying to view the female with the three cubs are causing traffic problems. If people do decide to stop, Scott advises the public to not approach the bears. He says Fish and Game plans to be in the area to ensure people and bears do not interact. And speaking of bears, they're definitely up and about, and it's been a glorious weekend. So everyone, well, maybe not everyone, but a lot of people have been out there hiking. And here with us today is Eric Boris, the executive director of Trail Mix, who keeps our the organization that keeps many of our trails in spot shape.
Thank you for having me.
Thanks for being here. So it's National Trails Day.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Saturday.
Okay.
June 1st.
All right. American Hiking Society has said it's National Trails Day. I think it's been going on for decades. And
it's been going on for a while.
Yeah. And here in Juneau, we're celebrating, too. So what's going on?
So this Saturday, so Trail Mix, working with the city, is working on the Outer Point Trail, North Douglas. Bringing it up to a higher standard than what it was, and we're going to make it wheelchair accessible down to the water, because there's very few places for people in wheelchairs to actually make it to close to the ocean, short of like a boat ramp. So we're working with the city to do that and improve the rest of the trail. We have a crew out there as we speak working on it, and then this Saturday we're going to have a volunteer day, so people can come out and help. Improve Juneau's trails. So Orca will be there with their patrons, and we're partnered with Saga and the Forest Service and the city and state parks and various other organizations to make it a big event. So we'll have a work crew working from 9 to noon, and then we'll have a picnic and speakers and activities for children from noon to 1.
Yeah, that sounds great. Mm-hmm. So, you know, Trail Mix is just part of the infrastructure of Juneau. Can we talk a little bit about what Trail Mix is, what its mission
mm-hmm.
is?
Yeah,
you know, we kind of all know what it is, but what is it?
What are we? Well, we're the stewards of Juneau's trails. So we originally started 20 years ago. It's our 20th anniversary. I keep forgetting to mention that, but it's very exciting. We were started because there are a lot of trails in Juneau will start on city property, then they'll go to Forest Service property, then they'll go to state parks property, and it's difficult for all those different land management agencies to work on each other's land. So Trail Mix started 20 years ago to be an agency that could do that. So that's what we do. We try and just, you know, whoever trail it is, we do our best to work on all of them and maintain all of them because we have a lot of trails, and we have and with all the rain and everything, there's a lot of erosion and there's a lot of wear and tear. So yeah, we're out there every year doing what we can to keep them up.
That sounds great. Mm-hmm. That's one of the amazing things of living here is the extensive and wonderful hiking trails we have.
It's pretty amazing,
and pretty diverse as well. That's great that Outer Point will become wheelchair accessible. That's really, really nice, mm-hmm. and it's a short trail, so it seems really feasible. What other trails are on the block for refurbishments?
Currently, we have a crew that's on Admiralty Island working on the Oliver Inlet Tram for state parks, and boy, did they get the weather. I don't think they're going to want to come back.
Right.
They're going to be out there. We'll be working on the Peterson Lake Trail in partnership with the Forest Service. The Port Peterson Lake Trail in partnership with the Forest Service. We did a lot of work on there last year, and we're going to continue that, improve that. It was a pretty muddy slog there for a while, so we're going to see what we can do. And we're going to continue to work on the Treadwell Ditch. That's been our top priority for a long time, and it's a long trail. It's depending on where you count the start as, between 17 and 14 miles, and hasn't had a lot happen to it in the last 100-some years, so we're doing our best to improve it. So we're working with the city and the Forest Service on that.
Is there any particular area that you're working on
now? We'll be focused on the part between Blueberry Hills and the Gastineau Meadows access points, and then headed south from Gastineau Meadows through that section.
So not from the Eagle Crest to the bridge?
Not yet. Next year, we're going to be putting in some new bridges in that section.
That'd be great.
Pretty massive bridges. So,
that
will really help things along.
Right. There's some mountain bike enthusiasts who like to do the trail.
Yeah.
So when you say we're working on the trail, who is we? Who are the people on the trail? Are these volunteers or these?
We have a crew of around 12. Mm-hmm. A lot of locals, a lot of people that move up for the job and then become locals. Mm-hmm. And young people that like to be outside and work hard and you know, not currently get rained on, but you know they will be.
Right.
So
eventually, hopefully, not for a little bit more. But and is it year round positions or is it only summer?
No, they work from they start in the beginning of May and then they work till the snow falls. So, yeah, pretty and we've almost made it to December 1st before, but not quite.
Right. So it's the reverse of snowbirds.
Yes, exactly.
Or ski bumps, or whatever you want to call them.
Yeah.
All righty. And if people want to help Trail Mix, they say, you know, I'm on a trail. It's really, mm-hmm. I'm so happy there's planking here or boardwork or whatever mm-hmm. you call. What do you call that?
Well, it depends on what we're doing. We call it planking.
Planking, okay.
Yeah, or boardwalk. Both work.
Okay.
I know what you're talking about.
Right. Well, you know, my daughter and I went up to Dan Moeller the other day just to go mm-hmm. to that bench to read. Mm-hmm. And we couldn't, this was about a week ago, mm-hmm. we couldn't get up there. There was so much snow and mm-hmm. we had the wrong mm-hmm. shoes on. And we were just like, wow, look, it's really low. So that's what I was thinking about, planking and the Dan Moeller Trail.
Yeah, it's a treacherous this time of year with the snow melting off of it.
Oh, yes, it was. And really deep, but maybe not so now.
Yeah,
now.
Where things are going.
Yeah, that's been glorious. But how do people help Trail Mix if they want to help Trail Mix?
Best way is to become a member. JunoTrails.org is the mm-hmm. way you can find out, or just Google Juno Trails and it'll be the first thing that pop up. And you become a member, that way we have various events throughout the summer. We have volunteer events, one a month, which will be on the website as soon as I get around to it.
Kind of one-man. Which will be right after this
show.
Yeah,
I know. One-man show in the office, so a lot of things get pushed back. But, yeah, I'll get them up there.
Especially with weather like this, it's days that you have to be out in the field.
Well, yeah, somebody has to make sure that this... so, yeah, becoming a member. And it's our 20th anniversary, so if there's every year to become a member, this is it. So, yeah, we have various activities throughout the summer, and we have fundraising events, and, yeah, we're always looking for people to help out. So.
Great. And yeah. What's the website again?
It's junotrails.org.
Okay, and is there a number if people want to just call?
Uh-huh, you can call 790-6406.
Great. Yeah. All right, well, thanks for joining us, and it's June 1. It's National Trails Day celebration here in Juneau at mm-hmm. Outer Point from 9 mm-hmm. to 1.
Yeah, and, yeah, I hope to see everyone out there.
Okay, great. Thanks for coming.
Thank you.
Hey, yo, little lady. Yo, little lady. When I was just a greenhorn buckaroo of 22, life's rodeo had thrown me. I was hung up and confused. My life just sort of grinded to a stop. So I went down to the barn to see my pop. He pushed his dusty cowboy hat back on his gray head. Said, son, I ain't learned much from this old cowboy life I led. Of course, there are some trail tips you might recall. To get you through this vexing veil of tears without a fall. Always drink upstream from the herd. Never look straight up at a bird. And when you get bucked off, get back on. And son, don't squat with your spurs on. The old little lady, the old little lady. Well, you know how Kit is. He don't take no one's advice. I had to drink downstream myself before I saw the light. True wisdom takes some time to understand. And it was only this morning at the crack of dawn when I pulled my breeches and my boots on and I strapped on my brand new silver shiny spurs with a hand engraved portrait of John Wayne and the 2 1/4 inch razor point rowel. And I stumbled over to the campfire for my morning coffee and squatted down to watch the sun come up and I suddenly realized I could still learn something from my dear departed dad. Always drink upstream from the herd. Never look straight up at a bird. When you get bucked off, get back on. And don't squat with your spurs on. Hey, you please don't lay. Everybody's got to squat sometime. Smart ones take their spurs off first. Hey, old lady.
Hello, you're listening to KTOO. It's May 28th. It's the Tuesday edition of Juno Afternoon. I'm Joan Partis. I'm sitting in for Martha Moore. And here with me is Mary Lou Spartz, a well-known Junoite, and John Irwin from the Maritime Museum of BC to talk about the Princess Sophia. Hello.
Hi.
How you doing?
Great. Thanks for coming into the studio today.
My pleasure.
So before we get going on what you guys are collaborating on, let's talk a little history. Let's talk about the Princess Sophia.
In 1918, in the last part of October, October 23rd, the Princess Sophia left Skagway in a blinding snowstorm, headed south, full capacity. Everything was full, and people were coming down from the gold fields, from the Yukon, and from going to catch the holidays, and also many young men were going to sign up to go to the war. This was 1918, in October. So that was the capacity, that was the kind of crowd it was, and she would be stopping in Juneau, and not sure of the other stops, but Juneau was her first stop after Skagway. She hit the reef there, and she got off course and hit Vanderbilt Reef and hung there. She just ground into it. And the captain decided that he would wait for help to come from Vancouver. This wasn't unusual. And her sister ship, the May, was to come up and take the passengers off of the Sophia, and then the crew would stay aboard, and that when the tide came in and everything was correct, then they would ease her off and they would get her safely to destination in Vancouver. Well, she hung there for 40 hours. Rescue was offered her, and it was refused, or it wasn't accepted, let me put it that way. And so at the end of that period of time, that these were small craft that came out from Juneau, fishing boats, there was a cutter. They came out and offered more than once to take passengers off, and they were not allowed to. The storm came up on, I think it was the evening of the 25th, and it was so bad that the small boats had to hurry for shelter behind Benjamin Island. And she'd survived those other mornings. And when they came back out the next morning, all that was left was a mask sticking out of the water. Hmm. She'd gone down.
How tragic. I knew the story, but I didn't know the story in such detail. Wow, that is really tragic. Just a bad call.
Mm-hmm. All lives lost.
Yeah.
Over 300.
A tragic call.
Mm-hmm. Over 300 people.
Wow. Because I just thought that, oh, they hit. They sunk, mm-hmm. but it was really a lot more in detail. So thank you for sharing that.
Oh, my pleasure.
Thank you for sharing that. And it also was good to know, like, who was on the boat. So this was like a transport boat. There were people coming from the fields, going mm-hmm. back, you know, the gold fields, going back. And it was not, you know, because I was thinking, was there a cruise industry in 1918?
Mm-hmm. Well, there was a tourist industry, but it wasn't in the fall.
In October.
Mm-hmm. No. And these were folks that were headed, mostly Canadian, were headed to their homes or families or friends for the holidays. This was mm-hmm. a happy time. Aboard were Christmas presents that were designated to go to the troops in right. France.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a wonderful story, too.
Well, if you're just joining us, you're listening to Mary Lou Spartz talk about Princess Sophia, and she was just talking about the Canadians on board, and we have a Canadian in the studio right now, John Irwin, the executive director of the Maritime Museum in BC. So, John, what is the collaboration, your
sure.
part in this?
Well, we've come to visit Mary Lou, and we've been at a couple museums today, the State Museum and the City Museum, and with Mary Lou's help, she's introduced us to the curators and the collection managers. I've come with David Leverton, the executive director of the Campbell River Museum on Vancouver Island, as well as John Firth, who's a longtime Yukon native and a well-read writer. So we've all come up with the idea to start planning for the commemoration, the 100th anniversary, which would be in 2018. And certainly there is huge relevance to this part of the world, in Alaska in particular, as well as in British Columbia and the Yukon. So, in fact, at the Maritime Museum of British Columbia, we've got the courtroom where, and it's still there today, where the trials were held after the disaster to try and deal with, you know, the lost, the people that were lost, and what, if anything, was going to be sort of done about the loss.
Anything done?
I think that it worked out to about $2 a victim, or $2 per person that was lost. So really nothing that, you know, would make anyone happy that was a part, or that had a, you know, direct impact.
I think it was about, 13 years of litigation?
It was just forever went on. But certainly there's, it's you know, the biggest tragedy on this coast in that field, in shipping and tourism. So it's something that this 100th anniversary, we really want to, you know, collaborate with these other institutions and work together to tell the story.
Right. Mm-hmm. And do you have, I'm sure you have lots of ideas, but mm-hmm. is there a vision shaping up that you want to share, or you're not at this point as far as...
It's certainly early days, but what we've done at the Maritime Museum in the past in British Columbia is worked with other museums and then had whatever exhibit we put together travel. Mm-hmm. And then because museums in today's world, you know, with dollars being cut back, if we can put something together that we can share, then fewer not everyone's doing all the same work. And it can go from museum to museum. And there's many around, both in Alaska, Yukon, and in British Columbia, that have some sort of mandate that fits with this particular disaster.
Right.
Our part in this disaster, and Juno's part, I'm saying, was to assist in the recovery of the bodies as they were brought in by the fishermen and by the other private boats that went out and found them along Lynn Canal, and to bring them here and to prepare them as best they could for shipment to Vancouver, those that were going to Vancouver. And this is where I think our emphasis needs to be. We were a very small town, and we'd just gone through the Spanish flu, the influenza. I believe we were either low or out of coffins, and we had very, very tiny mortuary staff. And here we were with this huge, huge undertaking of responding to this need. And I think we were very brave and kind community. I'd like to see us get a little credit for that.
Wow. How many people were living in Juneau at that time? I mean, you're painting a really, really full and vibrant picture, Mary Lou. Thank you so much. But I'm just curious, but 345 people that were just deceased on a tragedy at sea, how many people were living in Juneau? Because it just, the way you're painting it, I see mm-hmm. it so clearly that the fishing boats were trying to help. They had the Sea mm-hmm. Harbor, and then the Junoites were here to help.
I don't know exactly, but mm-hmm. I know in 1941 the population was about 6,000. I think that included the dogs.
Mm. Mm-hmm. So we should count the dogs if we need mm-hmm. 6,000. It was a small population. Mm-hmm. It was probably 1,000 dogs right there.
Yeah.
But so here we just talked about the human factor of getting the bodies where they needed to go, and you really, once again, painted a really vibrant picture of what that was. But also with the boat, was there a salvage work done on Princess Sophia? Like when we talk about a museum exhibit, what are we talking about? Are we talking informational, or has there been stuff salvaged from the ship?
Yes, the ship. There was a major effort, I believe, by the CPR to send down divers to check mm-hmm. the contents.
What is the CPR?
Oh, Canadian Pacific Railroad, the mm-hmm. owners
Which is
of the vessel.
The type of the ship
okay.
yeah. registered with.
Yes.
Okay. So they sent divers.
They sent mm-hmm. divers down to check for personal effects and to do what they could to salvage what they could. Mm-hmm. But mostly I think they were looking for things like a safe, and they were looking for personal effects in the cabins so they could return mm-hmm. them to the families. Ken Coates and Bob Morrison have a wonderful book, and they go into a lot of detail on these kinds of things.
And what's the name of the book?
The sinking of the Princess Sophia, taking the North down with her.
Oh, okay.
And this is where the collaboration comes in, because a lot of the different artifacts have gone to different institutions, the State Museum, the library here, the City Museum, even on Vancouver Island, our museum, and a few other institutions. So sort of the artifacts have been spread around, and there's individuals out there as well that have done their own salvage to some extent. So.
Right.
And there are divers that go down, you probably know, on the wreck now, local folks. And there is they may or may not take a souvenir now and then. They shouldn't. It's against the law, but people do what they do. So
since there's nobody down there 24/7,
there usually is
scuba.
Yeah.
All right. Well, thank you so much for this fascinating history lesson, and also talking about the 100-year anniversary of the sinking. And once again, thank you for filling in so many of the dots, because you read about something, and depending on what you're reading, it could be so incredibly flat facts and figures. But you really brought a really, really human element to the story, and it's really tragic that the captain was so sure that his way was, that's what a captain does, has to make a call, you know, and that he was waiting for help from his fellow countrymen.
Mm-hmm. Well, this wasn't the first time that a ship had gone, got high and dry, mm-hmm. on a reef,
mm-hmm.
and so this wasn't an exotic kind of thing. It was something that had happened in the past. And they were, but the storm that had put the ship off course and onto the reef was the same storm that kept the Princess May, which was her sister ship, from getting to her in a timely way.
Right, and then it was another storm that mm-hmm. ultimately led to the sinking. So.
The tides were against, well.
Many tragic circumstances.
Many tragic circumstances came together to cause this disaster.
Right. So have they ever done a movie about it?
Not yet.
No movie, but hoping.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah.
They're fishing for a deal, okay?
That's
if
right.
anybody
out there wants to do a movie, we got a script.
Yeah, exactly. That sounds great. Well, thank you so much for coming in and talking with us today.
Thank you, Joe.
Thank you.
Thank you, Jeff.
I will love you forever, my darling. My lover, Mrs. Harper, my one. And the north wind is starting to blow in. Hold tightly, my darling, hold. Thank you. goodbye and goodbye.
The Writer's Almanac for Tuesday, the 28th of May, 2013. It's the birthday of the author Ian Fleming, born London, 1908, to a wealthy family. His father was a member of Parliament. Young Ian worked as a foreign journalist. He was a banker, stockbroker, and assistant to the director of British Naval Intelligence, worked for the London Sunday Times, before he took up the career that would make him famous. As the author of the James Bond novels, the first one, Casino Royale, in 1953, a playboy spy, fast cars, nifty gadgets, and hot women. It's the birthday of Mae Swenson, born Logan, Utah, 1913, Swedish parents, immigrants who came to this country as converts to the Mormon faith. She was the oldest of 10 children. She became the black sheep of the family when she questioned the Mormon faith at the age of 13. Started keeping a diary, composing poems. Writing was the one place she felt free to express herself. She said, "I'm two eyes looking out of a suit of armor. I write because I can't talk." She was in her 20s when she moved to New York City, had a number of low-paying jobs. At one point, she shoplifted a dress so she'd look respectable when she went to the welfare office to ask for help. Her reputation and success grew slowly. Her first book came out when she was 41 years old. Another Animal was the title. She got a two-month residency at Yaddo, where she met the poet Elizabeth Bishop. They became friends, possibly lovers. And though Bishop lived in Brazil, they exchanged letters, 260 of them, over the next 29 years. Mae Swenson wrote to Bishop, "Not to need illusion, to dare to see and say how things really are, is the emancipation I would like to attain." Her collections include the complete love poems of Mae Swenson and a book entitled Dear Elizabeth, Five Poems and Three Letters to Elizabeth Bishop. It's the birthday of Walker Percy, Birmingham, Alabama, 1916. His early life was marked by tragedy. Grandfather, father, both committed suicide with shotguns. His mother drowned when her car ran off the road into a stream. He and his brother were adopted by their uncle in Greenville, Mississippi, and it was there that he met his lifelong best friend, the neighbor boy, the author Shelby Foote. Percy went off to college in Chapel Hill, later to New York for medical school. He got tuberculosis, spent 2 years at a sanitarium. He later said, "It was the best thing that ever happened to me because it gave me a chance to quit medicine. I had a respectable excuse." He became a full-time writer, wrote two novels, couldn't get either of them published. He kept at it, and his novel, The Movie Goer, came out in 1961. He was 45 years old, and a year later won the National Book Award. Here's a poem for today by Richard Wilbur, entitled Flying. Treetops are not so high, nor I so low, that I don't instinctively know how it would be to fly. Through gaps that the wind makes when the leaves arouse, and there is a lifting of boughs that settle and lift again. Whatever my kind may be, it is not absurd to confuse myself with a bird for the space of a reverie. My species never flew, but I somehow know it is something that long ago I almost adapted to. Flying, a poem by Richard Wilbur from his collection Anterooms, published by Houghton Mifflin and used by permission here on the Writer's Almanac, supported by the Wall Street Journal Weekend Edition, offering writing about finances, food, art, wine, and culture from around the world. More at wsj.com/celebrateweekend. Produced by Teresa Burgess. Be well, do good work, keep in touch.
Hello, you are listening to KTOO, the May 28th edition of Juno Afternoon. I'm Joan Pardis. Jeff Brown's in the studio, being my personal engineer. Thank you, Jeff, for all you do. And Steve Kosas is here from the Marie Drake Planetarium. Hello, Steve.
Hello, Joan and Jeff, and thank you so much for having me on this afternoon.
We are very happy that you came inside. So what's going on this evening at the Marie Drake Planetarium?
Well, the Marie Drake Planetarium always has a public show at the end of the month on Tuesday, and this is that Tuesday. And since this is a solar max year, we're doing a show on the Northern Lights. Every 11 years, the sunspot count is at a maxima. And sunspots have been counted since the 18th century. And this year, 2013, is a solar max. So there's going to be more northern lights visible. So our show tonight, the planetarium, will be on the northern lights. We'll have a short presentation on the current scientific theory of the northern lights. Then most of the show is going to be art inspired by the northern lights. It'll be presented by Christina Della Rosa, who's the president of the nonprofit board that runs the planetarium. It's all volunteers.
Yeah, that sounds great. So when you say it's a solar max, which means that there will be more northern lights activity visible, is that what I heard?
That's true. There's a causality. When there's more sunspots, which there is this year, every 11 years there's a local maximum of sunspots, then there's more solar flares, which means there's more chance for what's called a coronal mass ejection. And if that mass, which is charged particles from the sun, hits the Earth, then those charged particles are drawn into the magnetic field of the Earth, interact with the gases in the upper atmosphere, and cause what we call the northern lights. There's also the southern lights. They're actually symmetric because the magnetic field loops go from the north to the south magnetic poles. So that's what a solar max, briefly.
Wow, that's great. So if you want to see the northern lights, obviously it's really not quite dark in Juno. I mean, it's dark a little bit, but it's light. It's light.
That's true. And unfortunately, from about late April to late August, at our latitude, 58 degrees north latitude, we have midnight twilight. The sun doesn't get more than 18 degrees below the horizon from late April to late August. So unless it's a particularly bright display of northern lights, and the moon isn't out, that's the only way you're going to see them during the summer.
Right. And then if you say, okay, 2013, you're talking the calendar year, let's say, so we go, oh, in the fall when it gets dark, we should be on a northern light alert. I know that some people get, like, alerts from UAF or something like that as far as, oh, it's a good chance to see northern lights.
You yes, that's true. The Geophysics Department, UAF, has a website. And the charged particles of the sun have mass, so it takes them 2 or 3 days to get to the Earth. Light takes 8 minutes to get from the sun to the Earth, but charged particles have mass. Light is massless, so it gets here at the speed of light, obviously, 8 minutes, but charged particles take 2 or 3 days. So the forecast for the northern lights at the UAF website will give a 2 to 3 day heads up when there's going to be a display of northern lights.
That sounds great. That sounds great. So we're talking to Steve Kosas from the Marie Drake Planetarium. He's one of the volunteers who work there. He's obviously a wealth of knowledge, so you should go tonight and find out more about our sky. And what else is going on this summer? Every Tuesday, the last Tuesday of the month, you put on a show at the Marie Drake Planetarium. And do you have some special stuff coming up for the summer?
Yes, during the summer, it'll be on our website, mariedrakeplanetarium.org. Our other volunteer, one of our volunteers, Ken Fix, is going to have retro sci-fi films. So last Tuesday of next month, June 25, he's going to show a retro sci-fi film, Fantastic Voyage.
Oh, wow.
It's from the 70s, Raquel Welch, and nanomachines. And actually, the special effects are pretty good. I think it came out in the early 70s.
That would be really fun. So is that going to be the theme the whole summer, retro sci-fi?
Yes. Ken did a series of sci-fi films last summer. He's going to do this again.
And that's at 6:30 again?
6:30 p.m. As our show tonight's at 6:30 p.m. Our show is always free, and they're suitable for all age groups. Everyone's welcome.
Okay. And in case people don't know, where is the Marie Drake Planetarium?
Well, the Marie Drake Planetarium is between the swimming pool downtown and the Harborview School. It's right behind the artificial turf field that's surrounded by the fence, through the glass doors, and then the planetarium's right there. And it's been there since 1967, so it's an interesting resource in Juneau. It's actually the largest American dome from Seattle to Fairbanks.
Really?
Really.
Interesting.
It's a 30-foot dome. The Seattle Science Center, their dome's 26 feet. The Anchorage Planetarium, the Thomas Planetarium, is also 26 feet. Fairbanks has a mobile dome that's 10 feet in diameter.
Mm-hmm.
So we're the largest dome at 30 feet. The one in Vancouver is larger, but that's not American.
There you go. All righty. Well, Steve, thank you for joining. Do you have anything? I'm going to have to talk about some weather and some other stuff, but is there anything else you'd like to say before we go?
Well, the show tonight should be interesting because we're doing a fusion of science and art. And the presentation is great. I've seen it before. Well, I'm married to the presenter, so I have seen it before. So we welcome everyone to come.
And how long is the show?
After the show, we'll have a brief intermission, then we'll use the star ball to show the night sky tonight. So overall, it'll be an hour.
Okay, that'll be great. All right. Well, thanks so much. Okay, I'm going to go to the weather now. But thanks so much, Steve, for joining us today. And that's Marie Drake Planetarium at 6:30. You could search on the web, or that website one more time was?
MarieDrakePlanetarium.org.
Okay, thank you so much.
Thank you so much for having me.
All righty. Hello, I'm wrapping up Juno Afternoon. I'm Joan Partis in the studio with Jeff Brown, my engineer extraordinaire. The weather is mostly sunny, obviously, and it will stay that way. Tomorrow is going to be a little cloudy, chance of rain, still highs around 62. Wednesday night, rain likely, lows around 47. Thursday, cloudy, chance of rain, highs around 59. And it goes on and on, only chance of rain. Nothing saying rain for sure. So maybe we'll squeak out some more rainless days. It has been glorious. So if you miss a Juno Afternoon and want to listen again, you could catch it in other local, statewide, national, and international news at ktoo.org. Tomorrow, Lori Scanling is hosting Juno Afternoon. She'll be talking about Foster Parent Appreciation Month, talking with the executive director of the Juno Lyric Opera, the new executive director, Rosie Humphrey, talking about Southeast Rock Camp with guest Paul McDermott, and Colleen Goldrich will be here to talk about upcoming changes at Annie Kales. That Writer's Almanac, music and more Wednesday at 3. Thank you for listening. Have yourself a great day.
This is KTOO Juneau. We broadcast at 104.3 FM in downtown Juneau and Douglas. KTOO also broadcasts on these translators. In the Valley and Ox Bay area, tune to K276 AF 103.1. In Lemon and Schweitzer Creek, K269 AO at 101.7. Gustavus listens on K201 AM 88.1. K220 BT serves Hoonah at 91.9. In Excursion Inlet and Icy Strait, hear KTOO on K210 AS 89.9.